Succession number 29702, Reel 2.
They weren't always. Can you give us some idea of the reasons why? I mean, I think this is interesting, because these guys obviously claimed in good faith. Would you like to take that, General Hewson?
First of all, Roger, the Battle of Britain, as we know, resulted in a lot of claims which later on were not substantiated from either side. And there is correspondence, I think, showing that Washington was aware that some claims were not able to be justified. But bear in mind, the confusion of battle would not always make clear who did what to whom. I think the leadership was aware that there was a certain morale aspect. Psychologically, everybody, particularly those risking their lives, need to know that what they're doing is important. And third, remember the Army Air Forces at home in Washington, in the councils of the Army and Navy, were treated not much better than illegitimate children. And as a consequence, I think there was this conscious effort, without being deceitful, at least maybe to exaggerate claims. I remember the great arguments at this time over allocation of aircraft. And the Navy wanted them in the Pacific, particularly after Guadalcanal. And if you then weren't making effective use of them, measured by claims of destruction of enemy aircraft, why do you have them there? I think all these factors added to it, Roger, I think maybe among others.
Thank you. Cass, would you like to say a few words on this?
I think it's quite possible that in the battle itself, it's quite obvious that the same airplane was fired upon by 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe different gun positions. And it's quite possible, and reasonable and honest, that if the airplane was destroyed, that the claim would be made by the guns are fired almost in unison, 4 or 5 different positions, that the aircraft could honestly be claimed by any one of those set of guns.
One rather interesting little point which was mentioned to me by a former Luftwaffe fighter pilot, and that was that after attack, you advance the throttles full open, and the poor quality fuel that was being used at that time frequently meant that you would get a burst of flame and a great puff of black smoke from the exhaust stacks. And I wonder how many gunners thought that that was the result of their bullets striking home. Has anybody anything else to say on this particular score? Well, we'll move on. In the spring of 1943, the 8th Air Force day bombers were striking further and further into Europe, and the Luftwaffe brought more fighter units into operation, and the battles became really furious. So I'd like to turn to General Gallen again and ask him if there were any new weapons that were introduced, rockets, for example, or anything else, any new tactics that were introduced, because there is no doubt that in the summer of 1943, the losses to the day bombers steadily mounted.
Yes, first of all, we learned that we had to assemble a bigger number of units and fighters in one place, in one room, and to make the attack simultaneously instead of attacking by one squadron after the other. Then we started with new tactics. At this time we have improved our training. We put silhouettes of B-17s and any hangar and any plant everywhere where was a plane in which could be painted a silhouette. We painted it on this on, and we trained our pilots to attack this every time, even after a mission. They had to do 3 or 4 strafings against these targets. Let me see. We also improved our armament. We learned that we need more and stronger armament. I will talk a little bit later about all the tests we did to find out if there was another way to break up the formation. The first target was always to break the formation and then to shoot the enemy bombers down. But to break the formation was the most difficult thing. Also for the awards, we made a difference between shooting a bomber down out of a closed formation and break the formation, or shoot a bomber down which was already out of the formation. And in addition, we got and asked for more armor. Armor in the front and armor in the back. In addition to more own armament. This has led later on to the fact that we had special units which were very heavily armed and armored, and we protected these special squadrons by fighters to bring them this in the position. But this was not much later, this was in late 43, beginning 44 already. I think I'm a little bit advanced in the time.
Thank you. Would anybody else on the panel like to comment on the General's remarks? Or do we pass on to the American fighters? Unfortunately, Francis Gabreski was unable to be with us today at very short notice, and he would have been our P-47 expert. I haven't forgotten our good friend at the end here, but the P-51s didn't appear until much later. However, the Thunderbolt, the P-47, was brought over late in 42 and went operational in April 43. Cass Huff was concerned with fighter development at a place called Bovingdon at that time, and it's going to be on Cass's shoulders to tell us what he thought of the P-47 originally as a fighter, what its problems were, what its advantages were, and how it got on in the early days.
How much time am I allowed to talk about the joke? Obviously, the size of the airplane and its weight to the average throttle jack, to the average knee shooter, put it right out of the combat class just to look at it. However, because of the fine armament and its ruggedness, more than overcame, in my view, and I think in the view of all the jockeys that flew the jug, any of the shortcomings the jug might have had, in common with all combat aircraft of the 8th Air Force, at least in those days, it was short range. And one of the very first things that had to be done was to see what could be done to increase the range of the aircraft. As far as the aircraft itself is concerned, the guns were well positioned, heavy armament, as you know, no problems to speak of in the feeding of ammunition to those guns, some problems with the engine. I found that the engine problems, in most instances, I can say this being a jockey myself, for the fall of the man flying the airplane, in most instances, rather than the fall of the engine itself, expecting things from the machine that was never designed to do, particularly the engine was never designed to do. The average pilot, Roger, resisted the idea of flying at low RPMs and high boost in order to reduce the fuel consumption, but at the same time, reasonable speed. They felt that the plugs fouled more easily, and they did. But by and large, the P-47 came to theater with, I think, fewer problems than would be expected with something that had never been battle-tested. It was a great airplane to fly. How many of you 47 jet pilots here? Probably a lot of you. I think you'll have to.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 7 or 8.
I don't think any of you will disagree with me when I say that as a flying machine, it was a great one. As a combat flying machine, it was a great one too. Despite the fact that the first looks at this great big ugly heavy affair gave you to wonder whoever designed it for what purpose. Its record, however, is in the books, flown originally by the 56th, with Dave Schilling and some of the others who did such a fine job. I can remember Dave Schilling coming to me and saying, how the hell are we expected to fly this monstrosity? And yet, Dave, God rest his soul, did an outstanding job with it, as did Kibreski and some of the others who chalked up a lot of victories in the B-47. Roger, I could go on and on about the 47, but have I answered your question?
I'll disagree with him on one point. I think it was a beautiful airplane.
I didn't say it wasn't. I thought other people thought. Particularly the RAF.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You don't want to take any notice of the RAF. They're British and they're a funny crowd.
We don't.
Experiences.
A friend of mine flew over and landed to visit us one day in a P-47, and I said, let me try your bathtub. I flew it for 45 minutes, and I was never so scared in my life.
Of course, that was asking for trouble. They you have a biased man.
I would, Roger, excuse me, I would like to say, though, that one of the high points about the P-47 versus the Mustang was, of course, the liquid cool versus the air-cooled cylinders, and many a 47 came home, and I'm sure the experience from some of the pilots of the 47s, as well as radial engines and the bombers, had cylinders missing. We couldn't say that. We had a leak in the radiator, and you don't stop for refueling the coolant when you've got a leaky radiator. The one thing also I might ask General Gallant, if it's possible, Roger, to comment on some of the early tactics with multi-engine fighters on the rocket, the ME-110s and JU-88s on the rocket attacks the bombers.
Can we leave that one just for a moment, because that comes up a little later. It's a little later in the story. One thing that Cass didn't mention, well, if he did, I was asleep for that second, was the range of the Thunderbolt. Cass, can you tell us how the range was extended?
Well, the original combat radius of the P-47 was calculated to be about 115 nautical miles. It wasn't very far. That allowed a very few minutes for combat, about 3 minutes for combat, as I remember. When the zone of the interior, as they call it in those days, was queried as to what the hell they expected us to do with an airplane that could only fly that short distance, they replied that they had shipped already some drop tanks, bathtub type, held, as I recall, 200 and some odd gallons. Some of them came in and we flew a few of them, and I'm going to tell you they were pretty horrible. We fill them with fuel and that airplane waddled all over the place. Not only that, when you dropped them, they came up and hit the belly of the airplane. When you released the shackles, they came up and hit the belly of the airplane with the damnedest thump you've ever heard in your life. Scared you to death on the monitor. That's when General Hunter said to me, we must find some way to get additional range out of the airplane. There's only one thing to do, and that is give it more fuel, as I said to him. He said, I'm not stupid. I understand that. we set out to come up with something that would do the job. And you probably know the drug pilots know that I found that sitting in a bar one night, as strange as it may seem, listening to a couple of British types, RAF types, who had been in the Desert Air Force, telling how their mission was dropping water to isolated groups of British troops in the desert. And they used paper tankers to do it. They were made by Bowater Lloyd, just outside of London proper. I went down there at the time. So I went down and asked them about the tank. I think they would hold fuel. They said they didn't know. They never tried it. Well, we got some, and we found out that they would. But then a whole series of things had to be done to make that tank usable. You want me to go on, Roger? The tank we found would hold fuel for about 17 or 18 hours without beginning to leak too badly. After we put half a dozen extra wrappings of paper on the outside. They were shaped, cylindrical shaped tanks with an end on them, looked like a bomb. They held 108 gallons U.S. We had to design a shackle to hold them. The only thing we didn't calculate properly at the time was the fact that those tanks, where they were positioned on the jug, obviously weren't going to feed very well at high altitude. And I suddenly realized one day when my engine began to cut out on me that it wasn't getting fuel, and the fault was at the altitude. So we had to come up with a means of getting that pressurized. We asked the Air Service Command, who were never very cooperative with us, at least, because they resented some of the things we were doing, for pumps. And they said, no way, we can't get them for you. If we got it, it'll be months and months and months. So one night, after a couple of mild and bitters, I realized that the vacuum pump had an exhaust side, and there was pressure on the exhaust side of that vacuum pump. And if we could find some way to control that pressure, we would have the pressurization we needed for those tanks. And we found a method. We went to British Thermostat, who made a little device for us that as the aircraft climbed, the altitude increased, the pressure increased on the tank so that we could feed that 108 gallons right up until the last drop in the tank. And that was the one thing that made that tank usable. Well, glass elbows, too, because we found out that the rubber elbows we were using didn't all, the tanks sometimes hung up on there, so we got some glass elbows made that would snap when the tank was released from its shackles. That's a thumbnail. It took a little longer than it took me to tell you to do it, but it got done anyway.
How much range did you get out of the Thunderbolt with those early tanks?
We doubled the combat radius of action of the aircraft, which brought it up. We could fly, and I did fly the first four or five missions of those tanks, some 200 odd nautical miles from bombing with the tank.
Thank you, Cass. Well, now obviously we turn to General Gallen again and ask him what he and his pilots thought of the Thunderbolt when they first met it in action, and how they fared in combat against it. And also, were they surprised to see the Thunderbolt suddenly appear over the borders of the Reich?
It's a very good question. First, it came as we expected. The bombers were escorted. They were escorted by a big number of fighters. This has increased our difficulties, and we had now two enemies. One was the fighter, the escort fighter, and the other was the bomber formation. This brought up the need for us even to build bigger formation in order to get in one situation a numerical equality and to attack not at the earliest point possible, but to attack when you had the correspondent strengths assembled, and mainly to come from the altitude. we did have some respect for the Thunderbolt. There's no question. Soon we have captured some operational aircraft, and we have shown this to our fighters. I've flown it by myself. And my first impression was, God damn, in this cockpit you can walk. You do not need to sit and look at the front, you can walk around. But there's no question that this Thunderbolt did his job for the time in a limited range. And when we were able to attack when they had to leave, they were in a very good position. And this was a question of our ground leadership, fighter leadership on the ground. It has never been a very strong point in German aviation, German Air Force history. The British were very superior using radar for every purpose, not only to detect the enemy, but also to guide their own fighters. But would the 8th Air Force not have, if later on, the P-51, the results of their bombing and the range of their bombing would have been limited very much. But don't forget, we were in the severe situation that we had our fighters in the east, many fighters, fighter wings in the east, we had our fighters in Africa, we had them in France, we had some in Germany, we had some in Norway. So our whole fighter strength was spread around, and we had never enough fighters in Germany available against the attacks of the 8th Air Force. Experience already from the Battle of Britain that a twin-engine fighter, including the Lightning, is inferior to a single-engine, single-seater fighter, based upon the acceleration, based upon velocity, maneuverability, and many other things. The only thing a twin-engine fighter can be superior is in armament. So we bought our 110s and the 210s, and later also the 410, into operation, but they had severe losses immediately. And I myself have formed a test command, a test group, which had the obligation to investigate what armament could be used in which airplane against the bomber formation, the B-17s and the B-24s. And this, I would like to take the opportunity to tell you that we selected, if we had the choice, we selected always the B-24s. We liked them very much more. The defense fire was not so heavy, and they burned wonderfully, even if you had a near hit. So in this test unit, I have in my diary, we tested many, many weapons. Number one, we tested the 3.7 millimeter anti-aircraft in the 110 and in the 410. We tested the 5 centimeter, 50 millimeter tank cannon in the Messerschmitt 410. We tested the MK-103, two of them, in the Focke-Wulf 190. we tested the we called it naval warfare, the rockets, the 21 centimeter rockets, which were fired out of tubes against the formation. We tested these in Focke-Wulf in the 9109, in the 410, and in the Junkers 88. This rockets had, how do you call it, proximity fuses, and they were successful for a certain time. You could fire these big rockets at a distance of about 1500 feet, so you were still outside of the